ism, schism, game. Dinah, go to heaven in a Jesus name, Lord. We know and we understand. Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't.
FM, KCSN, and KCSN HD1 Northridge, Los Angeles. KSBR and KSBR HD1 Mission Viejo. A service of California State University Northridge and Saddleback College. Member-supported public radio. Streaming on the web at thesocalsound.org.
We get high in backseat circles. We break into mobile homes. We go to sleep to shake a pill. Never wake up on our own. And that's the way we get.
A very happy Wednesday evening to you all, and welcome back to The Soundtrack. I am your frequently bipedal host, Lev L. Spiro, and we have an amazing guest with us tonight. This gentleman... is it okay if I call you that? This gentleman has served as producer, showrunner, and most importantly, screenwriter on shows such as Just Shoot Me, Kitchen Confidential, Family Guy, How I Met Your Mother, Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23, Bones, Blackish, and Whiskey Cavalier. And in 2023, this gentleman, are you sure you're okay with that?
Gentleman's fine. I'm fine with gentleman.
All right. I didn't want to
It's inaccurate, but I'm fine with it.
Okay. Well, I didn't want to be presumptuous, but I should have given you a trigger warning or something. This gentleman was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay, and won, more importantly, the Writers Guild Award from his peers, for Best Original Screenplay for having written The Holdovers, which starred Paul Giamatti and was directed by Alexander Payne. Ladies and germs, please welcome Mr. Dave Hemmingson.
Thank you, Lev. It's very gracious of you.
Did we not have a studio audience tonight? I was expecting applause here, Matt.
Okay, Matt, I appreciate that. That's very kind. No. You're too kind. Thank you.
I thought this was a studio. Okay. Anyway, that is quite the list, impressive list of credits, my friend. Did you achieve all of that through relentless hard work and talent, or did you sleep your way to the top like me?
Kind of a delicious combination of the two.
Nice. I was, of course, joking with that. Joking by suggesting that by using sex as a strategy, I was ever able to get anywhere near the top. That didn't happen. Not like with you, but all right, listen. There are a million questions I would love to ask you about The Holdovers, but we're really here to talk about music, and specifically music in film and music in television. And I want to start by asking you about how you like to use music when you're writing. Do you have music playing when you're working at home? And if so, what kind of things do you like to listen to?
Yeah, I mean, I find music to be incredibly helpful. And typically, I wish I could tell you that I was multilingual, but I'm not. But I do like opera, specifically Mozart, specifically The Marriage of Figaro. I often write to this. I know it's crazy,
right? It's amazing I had this queued up.
I know. You're so telepathic, Lev. Yeah. I've always admired that about you. Yeah. This is just like kind of puts me in a smiley mood. And it's also, by the way, the opening cue of Trading Places. This is the credits music for the film Trading Places.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, yeah. I haven't seen that for a while. Yeah. That was a fun movie, though. So, and do you use different kinds of music for different moods? Does it depend on the scene that you're trying to write, or
you just throw stuff on and see where it takes you? I mean, you know, sometimes this is a great way to kind of start the day because it's sort of kind of very bouncy and very happy and, you know, Mozart, lots of notes. a little Amadeus reference. And then jazz, a lot of jazz for kind of the midday. And then I'll drop into rock and the station a lot kind of as the day winds down. But I kind of need it to be lyric-free at the beginning, at least at the beginning. And that's why classical, opera, and jazz. And then I'll segue typically into rock later in the
day. That makes sense, except for the opera part. That's not exactly lyric-free.
Not lyric-free, but I don't understand what they're saying. So
right.
It's sort of just... interesting glottal stops and like high pitched sounds that somehow, like a dog whistle, appeal to my inner child. I guess I don't know. I'm not sure.
Glottal stops, isn't that like Khoisan pig? What the pygmies do? Glottal stops.
No, I have to discuss it with them. We haven't ever talked about that.
Okay. No. So, how do you decide what you're going to start with? You like to start with the later stuff. You were saying.
Yeah. But, I typically start when I'm writing. I typically start with this is a great opera because it's just such a bouncy, fun, happy opera. And it's also a piece of music that I don't have to, if I listen to the entire thing, there's I stream like the Vienna Philharmonic version of it, and like it's a couple hours worth of music that sort of has a series of themes that kind of recur and kind of wind in and out. So, you know, it gives me a sense of consistency and continuity, and I try to sort of like, you know, sit in that chair and bang it out as hard as I can for as long as I can. And this, for some reason, encourages that degree of commitment. I'm not sure what it is about it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, some of the stuff that you had told me that you listened to, I was shocked by. Like, Sergeant Pepper's.
Yeah.
And that doesn't interview. Is it just you've heard it so many times that you're not really attending
to it? I've been listening to that since I was a child. I'm a rabid, unreasonable, kind of insane Beatlemaniac. I just think they're brilliant. I have everything they've ever recorded. I'm the kind of guy, I'm a completist. I've listened to everything, all the, you know, BBC sessions and the whole nine yards. And
is there a little OCD
going
on here?
Complete. Okay. I'm a completist when it comes to that. I'm just totally in love with them. And I just think that movie, like a lot of people feel that album is actually not as good as Revolver. And I can kind of see that. But there's something just so joyous about it. And so, I don't know. It just takes me to a time and place. And that I find to be incredibly incredibly inspiring. I mean, my good friend Larry Wilmore and I talk about the Beatles all the time. He's a huge Beatle fan too, and sort of like, I think Paul McCartney is just lyrically and musically a genius, and so I'm often inspired by listening to those songs, and they're just these earworms that have been around since '67, and they're to me as fresh today as they were then. So it's really inspiring to hear that level of genius sometimes. And just,
well, what happens if you're working on a really sad scene?
I don't listen to that then.
Oh, okay, that's a very good answer.
Yeah. No, I'll pivot to something. You know, typically a little more lachrymose if I'm going to do something that's kind of heavy. I'll kind of dial it down and kind of find something that's a little less bouncy. Yeah.
Very interesting. Are there any times that you just don't use music at all, where you just have to focus?
Sure. Sometimes, yeah. I mean, especially if I'm trying to beat a deadline and I'm panicking. then I'll just sort of like hunker down and close the door and put Do Not Disturb on and just do the best that I can to sort of like blaze through it, you know.
Very cool. Well, the next piece that I want to play is another band that I was very surprised that you use as it's going to be. There you go. We're going to play this one full for a sec.
I decline to walk the line. They tell me that I'm lazy. Worldly wise, I realize that everybody's crazy. A woman's voice reminds me to serve and not to speak. Am I myself or just another freak? You know there's fire in the hole and nothing left to burn. I'd love to run out now. There's no way left to turn. No. With a cough, I shake it off and walk around my yellow stride. Should I hide or eat my pride or wait until it's good and right? My life is boiling over. It's happened once before. I wish someone would open up the door. Don't you know there's fire in the hole and nothing burn. I'd love to run out now. There's no way left to turn.
When you told me about that one, I was like, how can you write to this? Such a great song. I would just be totally, I'd have to stop what I was doing and listen to the song.
Yeah, I think it's because the lyrics are so genius. I mean, they're such good writers, both musically and lyrically. You know, I mean, it little short stories, and they just paint this incredibly vivid picture. So sometimes it's nice to hear that degree of like this like bouillon cube of genius, this concentrated chunk of genius.
Oh, I like that. Yeah,
it's just a concentrated chunk of genius, but it's also an earworm. So it's like, I find it very inspiring. It's like I was saying, like, you know, about McCartney. Like, you listen to that, and you're like, this is this is wonderful, and it gives you kind of hope. You know, it's like, oh, if someone can do something like this, maybe I can approach, you know, in a very, very minor sense, that level of magic. So I think I find it inspiring sometimes,
too. Well, that's a great segue to my next subject, which is a film that you recently worked on called The Holdovers.
Yes.
Which starts with these words as a professor at a school sits in his chair grading papers, and he says, "Philistines, lazy, vulgar, rancid little Philistines." Those are the first words spoken in The Holdovers by Paul Giamatti's character. And I just, I recently rewatched the film a couple weeks ago and just burst out laughing. That's a genius line. It's
Thank
like,
you.
Did my friend Dave Hemmingson write that?
Yeah,
I suspect
did.
You did.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a few needle drop music cues in the film. So at any point while writing The Holdovers, were there specific cues that popped into your head or even made it onto the page?
Yeah. I mean, there was some stuff that, you know, I think I wanted to put in and were very much present in my mind when I was writing the picture. And some didn't get put in because of the sheer cost of the master use, right? So I think the Chambers Brothers is the first rock cue that we have in there. I mean, there's the song at the beginning, which is the first period rock cue is Time Has Come Today. And originally that was going to be
Stones,
yeah, Out of Time.
Yeah.
And that was a bit of an homage to Hal Ashby because it's the opening song of Coming Home. And I'm a huge Hal Ashby fan. And when Alexander Payne and I were talking about the movie, we both wanted to make the 70s movie. So I originally had scripted that as the cue, but you know, I think that
it would have cost the production budget for
precisely
the first
correct.
Act.
Yeah, the Stones are not approachable. So, in terms of economic reality for a small picture, So the Chambers Brothers thing were great, but you know that the Stones were scripted there. I'm trying to think of other cues that were scripted.
The Allman Brothers.
Elizabeth Reed. Yeah, that was scripted. That was scripted. I think it was scripted. Mm. But certain things dropped out. Like, you know, there was a Desmond Dekker cue that didn't make it in. And this is over the course of writing and rewriting the picture over,
right.
You know, a series of about 18 months. So I would put stuff in and Alexander and I would discuss it. And we decide, okay, we're probably not going to get that, so we can't get it. And then he and I would discuss and debate. Like, you know, I'd send a bunch of cues and he'd go, like, I feel like this works. And, you know, he's a genius. He's a brilliant, brilliant filmmaker. And so music is deployed very judiciously in his films, and he's very conscious and very careful in what he does. And so, you know, the Venn diagram of what he wanted to do and what I wanted to do, certainly on the page, matched up very closely. I mean, it was a fantastic working relationship.
I was just going to say, it sounds like you guys worked together very closely on this in a way that not that many writers and directors do,
yeah.
I speak from experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, I wrote the picture, but I would you know, send him acts and he would comment and I would rewrite. And, you know, I mean, it was about really getting the tone right because, you know, he's kind of an auteur. So it's like you want to get the tone right for the director. So I was very conscious of his other films and the mood that we both wanted to evoke. And the music was a huge part of that, you know.
It really was. And it certainly put you in that time and place.
Yeah. It's a period piece. So it's like getting the right music for the period. You know, I was very scrupulous when I was sending him cues too. I was like, okay, so this is like 70 into 71, which means 69 seems like a credible, you know, era. And Richard Ford, our brilliant music supervisor, was very careful about like making sure that the period cues were accurate. There's one or two cues that are actually contemporary cues that sound very period.
Interesting.
Just two songs in the movie. But others, you know, others that we loved and wanted to put in, but for various reasons couldn't either afford or manage to get our heads around.
I'd love to play one, the Badfinger cue.
Oh, man, I love that cue so much.
And can you describe the scene for us a little bit and the mood that you're
evoking? I believe this is the Boston trip, right? This is the walking up into the...
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So Mark Orton, who's our amazing composer, who also composed the music for Alexander's film, Nebraska, did a remarkable job of evoking both the period and the mood of the film. And we wanted very much to sort of have a degree of buoyancy to offset some of the sadder moments. I mean, I think The Holdovers kind of toggles between comedy and drama and sadness. And I was very conscious when I was writing it. And Alexander was very conscious when he was shooting it. And Richard was very conscious when he was sort of crafting the score and the needle drop for it. This song, I just think is just so wonderfully buoyant and kind of hopeful and, express sort of the possibilities that lay ahead for the trip when Paul and Angus show up in Boston and head to the Boston Fine Arts Museum of Fine Art, you know. So I just love this cue. I just think it's a great band too.
Let's check it out. This is No Matter What from the band Badfinger. I was just so struck both times that I saw this movie by how elegantly you crafted the arc of the relationship between the two main characters of Paul Giamatti and the student Angus.
Yeah, Dominic Sessa.
And, you know, they hold each other in extremely low esteem at the beginning. And then they slowly start having these moments where they're empathizing with each other. And every time they start coming together, you throw a wrench at their heads and knock them back out. Yeah. And it's like, it's maddening, but it really makes you root for them and want them to. I mean, it creates this lovely tension.
Thank you. No, it's a love story. Home movie is a love story, really. You know, it's just about these three broken people who learn how to love each other in the kind of the season of miracles. And it's funny because listening to that song just now with you, what hits me over the head, and I didn't even realize it until now, was that that's a love song, and it kind of scores their growing affection when they get to Boston. Hmm. Also, speaking of the Beatles, Badfinger on Apple, which is the Beatles label, produced by Mal Evans, that song, who was the Beatles roadie, which is crazy.
Right.
So it's got a heavy, I think, a Beatley connection, so I think I feel real, really a fond of that song for that reason. My best friend Sean Francis Barry and I are huge Beatle fans, so he and I talk about the Badfinger Beatles connection.
You're striking me as kind of a musicphile.
Yeah, no, I love it. And I listen to 88.5 all the time, so it's like it's a real honor to be on here.
And I know he's not just saying that because we're on 88.5. He actually does listen to 88.5.
Yeah, and I was a slobbering fanboy about all the DJs and the programming before we went on air.
Slobbering fanboy.
That's me, slobbering fanboy.
All right, I have a non-musical question to ask you. It snows an awful lot in the first act. Was that scripted and made by machines?
Absolutely.
That wasn't just like nature's contribution to the film?
It was partially nature's contribution. We got lucky. Actually, the second day of shooting, we were shut down for a day, almost a day and a half.
Too much so.
Yeah, second largest blizzard that ever hit Boston hit us the second day of shooting. And we were actually into Devine Joy Randolph's first big scene. And, of course, she won everything. I mean, she won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for her role as Mary. She's a brilliant actor.
Yeah.
And we were just hitting a rhythm on that, and the Teamsters kind of walked in and said, like, nah, the trucks can't get out here. We got to get out. So the snow was it was a bummer. We kind of resurrected it and got back into the mood. But, you know, the snow was natural for a good deal of it. Well, problem is we'd get a ton of snow, and then it would melt off. And then we'd have to sort of, like, shoot around the patches that were melting because it would toggle between, like, 25 degrees and 60 degrees in Boston. It was crazy.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I know something about the vagaries of weather and shooting. Actually, the last time I was in Atlanta, it was in the winter. It snowed about a quarter of an inch, and they shut everything down in the middle of a huge snow. I was like, what? Come on.
I
lived in Wisconsin for 9 years. You know, this is not snow. That's not snow. Very funny. I wanted to mention, well, why are we playing The River right now by Joni Mitchell? Because you told me this was actually the song you wanted to have playing over a certain part where the kid gets his glove thrown.
Yeah, Koontz confronts Allerman at the river and throws the glove in, and he watches it float down, you know, and Angus says he orphaned that glove on purpose so the loss would sting that much more. And, you know, in an act of defiance, poetic defiance, Allerman throws his other glove in the river and watches it float down. And that kid was just so brilliant. And Alexander did just a magnificent job of just holding on his face as he watches it float down, sort of an allegory for the loneliness of being stranded at the holidays, you know. And this was the song that I think Alexander and I both wanted. But again, you know, the exigencies of producing a movie, you don't always get what you want. But Mark Orton scored that moment, and I think, honestly,
it was beautiful.
He did a better job than, I mean, this is Joni, and she's a genius, but I prefer the Mark Orton score in that moment.
I was also struck by the fact that there was no Hollywood kid acting in the film. They were all really good.
Yeah, that's Susan Schottmaker. Yeah, Susan Schottmaker, our casting director, who did an amazing job. She won the BAFTA for casting. And this year, there's going to be an Oscar for casting, finally. And I think casting directors have been ignored by the Academy for decades, and they absolutely deserve a category. I mean, there was no kid acting because Alexander's a great director, and Susan's a fantastic casting director.
That's for him. All right. I want to move on from The Holdovers. We may come back to it. But I'd like to ask you about some of your all-time favorite musical moments from movies and TV. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about this before.
Yeah.
And the first thing that you said with a giant smile on your face was you mentioned the George Harrison-produced comedy With Nell and I.
Yeah, my favorite comedy of all time. Scored by David Dundas, by the way.
And this was from, what, 1990?
87.
And I love the way you described this theme to me. You said it was kind of a messed up circus vibe.
Yeah, Broken Calliope. Kind of like, it's got this sort of odd, off-kilter, kind of loping, comical sadness to it, you know?
Yeah.
And it perfectly characterizes the relationship between Withnell and I, the character Marwood. If you guys haven't seen this movie, seek it out. I think you can get it on Max now. It's a phenomenal comedy. One of the greatest honors of my life was when I was back in London for the BAFTAs, I got to host a double feature of The Holdovers into, actually, the Withnell and I into The Holdovers.
Oh, really?
And I addressed an audience. I took questions from the audience about this, but this film is hands down the biggest comedic influence on my writing, I think, ever. I just love
it. How so?
It's incredibly dyspeptic. It's incredibly, it's full of desperation and black comedy. And again, like all of my favorite movies, it's a love story between these two men who have to leave each other because their lives are diverging, but it's set in London in 69, and I'm a huge Anglophile and I love London. And it's just, they go off to Penrith, Wales. They say, we've gone on holiday by mistake. And so there are all these impediments that like land on them, you know, surly poachers and randy uncles and strange locals and people in tea rooms.
Don't
and
knock
pubs.
Randy uncles.
Yeah. Right. So the whole thing is this sort of weird assault on their dignity. And the two of them are so specific. Bruce Robinson wrote it as a novel, and it took 20 years to get it made. And
wow.
finally, George Harrison made it. And it's basically a three-hander. So it's Paul McGann, Richard E. Grant in the role that I think would define his career, and Richard Griffiths, the uncle from the Harry Potter movies, plays Uncle Monty. And it's basically a three-hander.
Was the audience in London conversant with the film?
Oh, dude, you have no idea. It's considered to be, I think, the number two British comedy of all time. So the Brits in particular, like, love this movie. You know, BFI does a series of books, the British Film Institute, and there's a whole kind of slim but very comprehensive volume breaking down every single millisecond of this movie.
Oh, my God.
This movie's, like, beloved in Britain, beloved.
And by you, and yeah. The way you describe it, I can completely see why you pick that.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's hilarious. Piece. It's sad. Like, everything that I was going for with The Holdovers, which to toggle between, you know, an increasing sense of absurdity and comedy and sadness and kind of personal revelation, like kind of trying to balance those two things. I think that tone and that methodology is completely in Withnell and I.
So here's another piece of music that you mentioned to me, which I think the audience will recognize. You specifically said Godfather Part 2
mm-hmm.
when I said, okay, tell me some of your favorite all-time piece of music.
Yeah.
So tell me about this one. Why does this resonate with you?
You know,
so
it's
much?
Weird. Even as we're talking about it, you know, you don't want to say Chestnut because it's not a Chestnut. It's a Godfather. But like everybody,
it's one of the greatest films ever made.
It's Nino Rota, right? So this is incredible. And it's just so evocative. I mean, you know, you hear this and within two notes, three notes, everybody recognizes it, right? And
evocative not just in terms of setting the time and place, but also the emotional content.
The emotional content. And like, this is a tragic family saga, right? And there's a beauty and a tragedy and a majesty to this. And I think that it always moves me just to hear it because I think it's so wonderful and so perfect, you know? And then here you've got this sort of almost like rugged rural Italian kind of concertina thing going on, you know? So it's like the sweep of the orchestra, but then it gets kind of small and very place specific. And I love it for that reason, you know.
Amazing. Makes me want to see the film again.
Yeah, I watch it a lot. I have it on my DVR, and I'll just cue it up sometimes just to like look at some genius.
And then we're going to listen to one more cue that you mentioned as one of your favorites, which is one of my favorite filmmakers of all time, the Coen Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were talking about music, you said, well, The Man and Me by
yeah,
Bob Dylan.
Absolutely.
Like, oh, Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I forgot, so you told me why you like that cue in particular so much. And I think it's the first cue in the movie, right?
Yeah. It's the
opening
first,
credits? Or?
It's the opening credits cue, yeah. If you listen to it, it's sort of just commemorates the dude. It commemorates Jeff Bridges as, you know, Jeffrey Lebowski. It's sort of like kind of epic and a little self-conscious and a little self-aggrandizing, but also kind of stony and fun at the same time.
Yeah.
And, you know, this guy's kind of working through his own self-awareness on this, in the song, the narrator of the song. And Dylan is just great. You listen to the lyrics, they're great.
Man in me will do nearly any task. And ask for compensation, there's a little he would ask. Take a woman like you to get through to the man in me. Myself, I might not take it anymore. Take a woman like your kind to find the man in me. What a, what a wonderful feeling, just to know that you are. That's my heart a-reeling from my toes up to my ears. The man in me will hide sometimes to keep from being seen, but that's just because he doesn't want to turn into some machine. Take a woman like you to get through. Man in me. La 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 la.
We are going to continue this fascinating conversation with our amazing guest Dave Hemmingsen right after we hear a few words and thank some of our underwriters. Stay tuned.
It's live music time again as the SoCal Sound is back with our first show in over a year. Saturday night, June 15th, join us at the historic Alex Theater in Glendale for our Benefest show featuring four great acts, including Jay Bird.
Yes, you if you love her and you nod and say, oh, oh.
Cayucas. Gems.
Take me back to the time when I had not a thing to wait on my
and Pete Yorn. Benefest, Saturday night, June 15th. VIP seats are limited. Proceeds go to support public media and the SoCal Sound. Reserve your seat now at Ticketmaster.com. That's Ticketmaster.com or at thesocalsound.org.
Thanks to our partners at Subaru of Glendale.
Hey, this is Jet from the SoCal Sound Morning Show with some record releases and reissues coming out this week. The Marías will drop Submarine. Willie Nelson is releasing his 75th studio album, The Border. Gravity Stairs from Crowded House will come out. REM's Fables of the Reconstruction will see its vinyl reissue. The Crooked Boy EP from Ringo Starr will be available on black vinyl and CD formats. Check out Ringo Starr's conversation with Nick Harcourt about the new EP at thesocalsound.org. For more music news and information you can use, listen to Mornings with Nick Harcourt and Jet every weekday, 6 to 10 a.m. only on 88.5 The SoCal Sound. Thanks to our friends at Atlantic Records, the SoCal Sound has your chance to see the Marías at Hollywood Forever Cemetery on August 23rd. You can find contest rules and enter to be eligible for a pair of tickets at thesocalsound.org. No purchase necessary. Information at ticketweb.com. The Marías, Hollywood Forever Cemetery, August 23rd.
Getting you.
Food Forward, Inc. is a local nonprofit that fights hunger by preventing food waste through rescuing surplus produce across the region and donating it to communities experiencing food insecurity. On Saturday, June 1st at CSUN's Orange Grove, Food Forward invites the community to join them in the fight to end hunger and waste. This free community and family-friendly event is an opportunity to make a difference. Harvest fruit for the community. Celebrate with games, refreshments, and activities. The event is open to all ages and free to attend. To register, visit foodforward.org/zestfest to secure your spot. Together, we can build generational health.
We are here talking to Dave Hemmingsen, the screenwriter of The Holdovers, amongst many other fantastic projects. And the last thing we heard was Bob Dylan's The Man and Me. We were talking about Big Lebowski. And that brings us to the subject of music's role in comedy,
yeah,
one that's near and dear to my own heart. Now, you've written and produced for multi-camera shows like Just Shoot Me and How I Met Your Mother. And you and I have worked together on single-camera shows like Kitchen Confidential and Don't Shoot the Bee in Apartment 23. I guess I should explain really quickly for the audience. Multi-cameras filmed in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. It's proscenium-style staging with four cameras. You shoot the scenes all in one, you know, take. And single cameras, no different than film. So how do you use music differently in those two formats?
You know, I think they serve different functions. Like, for example, mm-hmm. you typically have a laugh track in a multicam.
Right.
And that's to tell the audience at home what's funny.
Typically means always, right?
Yeah, always. Yeah, always. In a multicam. You know, and if you've ever watched, I think at YouTube they've got certain shows where they pull the laugh track, and
yeah.
I think Big Bang Theory, they've done that, and it's really interesting because it's so jarring because you're so used to that rise and fall, you know,
yeah.
that kind of sine wave of laughter that tells you what's funny, basically, right?
Right.
And I think those are mostly used. Music is typically used for stings, right? So it's basically to get in and out of scenes.
So transitions?
Transitions, precisely. Mm-hmm. So you're stinging the scenes, your ins and your outs, right? That's what you're doing with a multicam. In single cam, and I am old enough to have started fairly early in the kind of resurrection and kind of elevation of single camera comedy, because there was no laugh track, it was often the job of the music to sort of tell you when to laugh. So sort of the, like, kind of creeping sense of mischief or whatever, and then there'd be rest and occasional sting. So the music almost functioned like a laugh track in early single cam, and it still does to a great extent, you know? I mean, it kind of guides you. And then the needle drops, the master uses that are sort of just fun songs to drop in, typically don't appear in multicams. Occasionally you get a montage that gets one, or a love scene, or a serious moment,
right,
in a multicam. With the exception of How I Met Your Mother, and Carter and Craig, the two creators, are musicians, and they had a band called The Solids, and so they used a lot more music in that multicam, which was what we call a hybrid, because, you know, it was shot without an audience over 3 days, so it wasn't quite the traditional multicam, but that's an exception to the rule. The master use of the needle drop in single camera is typically to score moments of importance or to heighten the energy, depending upon which one to do.
I want to go back to something you just said. You were talking about the early days of single cam.
Mm-hmm.
And so to see if our mythologies line up. For me, it really started, I started getting a lot of work around 1999, 2000.
Sure.
I had done the show Arliss,
yep,
on HBO.
Of course.
So I
Robert
was in this.
Wool, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was Malcolm in the Middle. It was the success of that show,
yeah, totally,
that made everybody go, oh,
yeah,
single camera, this is what comedy, yes, should be now. And I was really fortunate because I was in this small group of directors, maybe like 40 people, mostly men, who the studios thought, well, they know they're film directors, but they're also good with comedy, because the comedy directors were multi-camera guys.
Exactly.
And the film directors were drama. So
exactly.
It was good. It was a good group to be part of. But I think I worked on every failed sitcom in the first part of the aughts.
Yeah.
The first 5 or 10 years.
That was easy to do. There was a lot more comedies made, and a lot more comedies would go up and go down back in the day. Like, there was that hammock between, especially that hammock between Friends and, I think, Frasier, you know, and they would just cycle, yeah, through tons of shows. And there was, back when I started my career, I started my network career probably in 96, 97.
Mm-hmm.
And so the landscape was just chock-a-block with half hour, and it was all multicam. And to your point, Arliss, which was an HBO show, right?
Yeah.
That sort of tease people into it, and then there was the brilliant show Larry Sanders,
right?
Sort of,
oh,
kind,
yeah,
of,
yeah,
set the bar super
that,
high,
that was
super high,
yeah,
right, in the mid to late 90s. But then it sort of became, you're right, I mean, Fox and Gail Berman greenlighting Malcolm was the thing that changed everything, really.
Yes.
I think you're right, yeah.
I saw you actually had done Cracking Up,
yeah, with Mike White, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I was hired for one episode of that. Mm-hmm. I came in 3 days in a row, and there was no script because Mike White had kind of cracked up.
Yeah, Mike is a genius. He's an intense guy, you know. Yes. And it was a great experience. But I mean, the great thing about
oh, I got paid for the episode.
Fantastic.
That was a happy
That's
ending.
That's the point.
Yeah.
Happy ending. The interesting thing about that show was because he had so much juice and has so much juice. But, you know, between, you know, Chuck and Buck and Orange County, and then School of Rock came out when I was working on that show. We had Jack Black on that show. We had John C. Reilly on that show.
Cool.
You know, Jason Schwartzman was the star. Molly Shannon was the star. And we just had great directors like yourself and Miguel Arteta and all these other phenomenal directors would come in. And that was, hands down, really my introduction into that kind of really high quality, really interesting, voice-specific single-camera comedy.
It was a very interesting time. I mean, it still is. So what is your philosophy of music for undermining or not undermining, underscoring or scoring comedy?
Yeah.
How do you like to use it?
Judiciously, you know,
okay.
like the habanero pepper. Like, you want to basically just drop in music to accentuate a scene. You want to use rests effectively so that, like, the music stops or kind of drops out so that you can deliver a joke or let a punchline land. So it's really about accentuating the comedy, not getting in the way. Mm-hmm. The key thing about music in comedy is don't let it get in the way. Like, comedies that are overscored tend to fail because, just like putting a laugh track all over everything, it feels like it's telling you what to do. Like, music should be used to sort of accentuate and not instruct, right?
That's the big bugaboo for me. If music is overtly funny and saying, hey, this is comedy, you should be laughing at this scene.
Exactly.
It's a huge turnoff.
Totally. Because, you know, you want to discover that on your own. You don't want somebody to tell you that.
I think it can also be very energizing. For me, I'm very sensitized to the rhythms and the energy that it imparts.
Understand, so. Because comedy is rhythm, right? Comedy is like jazz.
Very much,
it's like,
yeah.
You got to find that rhythm, you know? But honestly, comedy in music and comedy is kind of like music and horror films in some respects, because comedy and horror films, I think, share a great deal.
Especially when the comedy doesn't work.
Exactly. Then it's just, you want to die. You want somebody to come in with, like, you know.
I point this out to people. It's like when, you know, if you have a drama and it doesn't quite work, then you just have kind of a mediocre film. If you have a comedy that doesn't work, it's a disaster.
Yeah, because you're standing there drenched in sweat and everyone's looking at you and it's a horror film.
Or basically, you're sitting in a theater that nobody is laughing at your stuff.
Yeah.
It's horrifying.
Agony. But, you know, comedy and horror are similar in that, like, it's about setting up a premise, reinforcing that premise, and then reversing that premise or surprising the audience. But in comedy, you're surprising with a laugh, right? Kind of cognitive dissonance. And with horror, you're surprising with some sort of terrible thing that happens that you're kind of not expecting. So it's about surprise, right? And you got to be careful with music, because you don't want music to ruin the surprise. And it's in comedy and horror, it's all about surprise. It's about being surprised by the subverting of a premise or the subverting of a situation.
Very well elucidated. I'd never thought of it exactly like that before. I know there's a reason I'm playing Booker T and the MGs right now. I think you mentioned this track to me, but I can't remember in the context.
It's this one and Green Onion. Green Onions. Green Onions is the...
Green Onions, that's like my go-to magic band-aid for any scene.
That,
it works.
That, there's a great producer by the name of Jeff Morton. I don't know if Jeff's listening, but Jeff Morton produced a bunch of my pilots and produced... Like,
I think I've done maybe 15 episodes for Jeff.
Jeff's a great guy, and he's a great producer, and he is the one who advanced the concept that Green Onions and Booker T and the MGs are the ultimate sort of comedy go-to.
He's right.
This is a little more kind of smoky late night, Booker T and the MGs. Green Onions is sort of like the bouncy sort of feel-good track that you can drop in anything as temp score.
Anything.
Yeah. But again, temp score, you and I are both familiar with temp score.
Like, oh, yeah.
You know, oftentimes when you're producing something, you don't have the rights to something, but you'll drop it in when you want to show a cut to the studio or the network because you want some. You want to be dry. You want music in there. You know, if it's dry, then...
Oh, I would always score the heck out of all the directors.
Absolutely, man. So, like, that, the, you know, Green Onions was sort of the jokingly, we'd say that was the Swiss Army cue. Swiss Army cue.
The Swiss Army cue. Brilliant. Let's see if I can get to this. You had also mentioned when we were talking about comedy... You brought up the film Rushmore and Mark Mothersbaugh's work on Rushmore.
Yeah.
And so can we play that? Oh, there it is. In somebody else's hands, this would really be over the top, but it's very delicate.
We were talking about Mozart before, right?
We were.
This is more Bach than Mozart, really.
Sure.
But it's still got that bouncy kind of, you know, classical thing going on.
It is upbeat, yes.
And the great thing about Mark Mothersbaugh, who's a great composer, you know, started out in Devo. Right here, it's just great. Like, and then I think we'll cut to the sleigh bells in about 5 seconds.
I hear them. They're going.
Yeah. There they are. And then they'll kind of take over the mix a little bit. Here, they're coming up in the mix, but very pizzicato, very pitsy. And the pitsy kind of strings, that's fun, you know?
It's all very fun.
Yeah, no, he's great, and he's so Wes, you know. Although I know he does other stuff as well, but I just think of Wes Anderson when I think of.
I was tempted to play the track right after this one, just because I like the name so much. The name of the cue is "Piranhas Are a Very Tricky Species."
That's when Max is talking about building the aquarium.
Okay,
for Miss Cross.
Well, and it's just driving drums the entire track. Yeah. Okay. Leaving comedy aside, that was a really fascinating conversation. Thank you for talking about that. How do you like to use music in TV and film in a more general sense? What is your favorite way to use it aside from comedy? And what purpose does it serve?
You know, it's very visceral, right? Music is, you know, they talk about even as you get older and perhaps memory issues crop up, music is the one thing people automatically default to. I think it's very deep human emotion. So for me, it's really about just finding a way to evoke emotion. Laughter is certainly something I want to evoke, but you know, I mean, a good example would be in The Holdovers. We kind of deployed Mark Orton's fantastic score very carefully in moments that we wanted to accentuate, but it's really almost like a haiku. You got to be really careful and just a few notes sometimes, and other times you can go, you know, and go longer. But I think it all depends upon the scene, and I think it all depends upon the message you want to send and the tone you want to evoke in that scene. And also, over the course of a film, especially, like, there's an arc, right? So you kind of want to hit people with comedy and drama alternately, so they're leaning in as you're telling them more about the characters, and you're ideally drawing them in and making them suspend their disbelief even further and really invest. So I think using music to do that is hugely important to me, and like something that I paid very careful attention to.
You told me about a scene that you had struggled with writing, where Divine's character Mary is unpacking a box of baby things in her sister's house, and that you tell the story.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote that scene for like a month, and in the scene, it's sort of like what's in the box. We'd established this box that she kind of cherished before she went to a party, and then she takes the box with her to her sister's place, and we don't know what's in the box. Mm-hmm. And we get to the nursery at her sister's house. Her sister's about to give birth. She's very pregnant. And Devine, who's lost her son, or Mary, who's lost her son, Curtis, in the movie, and is devastated by the loss of her son, opens the box and pulls out a pair of baby shoes. And I had written dialogue for when the sister comes in, they talk about what happened and kind of try to reconcile it. And I struggled with it for like a month. And I finally realized that the problem with the scene wasn't the words I was writing. It was the fact that I was writing words at all, that there was no emotion that could express the enormity of her loss, right? If there's anybody entitled to despair, it's this character, it's Mary, right? And she and her sister just hug, and it's not a moment of despair. It's a moment of actually hope and transcendence, right? But putting dialogue in there didn't do it justice, because there were no words that I could come up with that would adequately express what was going on. Mark Orton's score, the way it comes in, and it comes in right as she takes the shoes out and puts them on the bureau, and then it just sort of like very, like I said, that haiku, it just very subtly maintains a presence throughout the embrace, and then there's a lap dissolve, and you see them laughing on the bed, and Peggy's her sister. Peggy's husband walks by and looks at them laughing and kind of shakes his head and smiles and keeps moving.
Yeah.
That's pure Alexander Payne genius. I mean, I wrote that, but the way he executed it was amazing. And
that whole music played out just musically, no dialogue.
Yeah, no dialogue. Mm. So, you know, as a verbose person, like, and a comedy writer who, you know, traffics in jokes sometimes, it was very important for me not to say anything in those moments and to let the music take over and tell the story and tell it very sparsely so that people could fill in their own emotions, right? Give the audience room to feel something, and that means not crowded sonically.
Well, and so well done. Both times I saw the film, I was not conscious of the music at all. So, and I know that Orton did an incredible job, but I would really have to go back and force myself to not be involved in the characters and just attend to the music. And it functions that well.
Thank you.
That it sucks you in. It conveys all the emotions that the filmmakers are trying to convey.
Yeah, and that's, you know, honestly, that's Alexander Payne and Mark Orton and Richard Ford. Like, those guys.
There's this other guy, Dave Hemmingson,
I think, who
did some of the writing.
Yeah.
Now, let me change the subject briefly, because I also asked you, I was being a smartass. I was like, tell me when music has worked really badly for you. And you gave me such a good example
Which one was it?
It was from Rio Bravo.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course, yeah. Like, I'm a huge Western fan, uh-huh. And there were, and it didn't only occur in Westerns. It occurred in a lot of movies in the 30s, 40s, and
50s. Is this Howard Hawks' Rio Bravo?
This is Howard Hawks' Rio Bravo, John Wayne, Dean Martin, Ricky Nelson.
Dean Martin and Ricky Nelson.
That's why you
have
to have...
like a big pop star at the time, right?
That's why you have to have a song from both of them. You cast those guys, you got to put a song in there. But for me, it was always about, like, don't let it take you out of the movie. And this is in the middle of a fairly
a Western.
Yeah, a Western, a comedically tinged Western, but this is Dino, right? Dean Martin.
Yeah.
And this isn't just for no reason. They do the entire
song.
Well,
studio notes.
Yeah, studio
notes.
All right,
look, I'm paying for Dean. We're paying for Ricky. They're going to sing.
They got to sing. So how about this? And this is the song, yeah.
So they're just in a saloon, and they start singing for really no reason.
They're waiting for these killers to show up.
Yeah.
You know, the opening scene of the movie is wordless and brilliant, but there's like, death on the horizon.
Yeah.
And
so this is what you would say when there's
out together,
death
and
on the horizon.
And this is them hanging out with death on the horizon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just my rifle, pony, and me. Gonna hang my sombrero on the limb of a tree. Coming home, sweetheart, darling.
Do you prefer writing for film or for TV? What are the joys and pains involved in these things?
Yes.
You enjoy employment.
Yeah, yeah. I like being employed. I love them both. There's Ricky Nelson joining Dean Martin. I love them both. I'm really blessed and fortunate to have been employed in both. I think television, it's kind of, you got to feed the beast. So it's a constant, you know, it's a constant churn. You got to keep going, keep going, keep going. And also, I think that television is one big long second act, right? I mean, your pilot's your first act. You establish the concept and the story, and you incite the journey, right? You go on the journey. The whole TV series, the season after season, is second act. So you're kind of amending and restating what these characters are doing and complicating things. And then at the end, whether your finale is one episode or three episodes or a season, you're concluding, but it's years and years of being with these characters, which is fun. You know, you get to know them. But the problem is you're constantly sort of having to reinvigorate the narrative and reinvigorate the struggle. With film, you got to back all that stuff into a two-hour parking space, right?
Uh-huh.
So it's much more demanding, but I find it to be really satisfying because it's a high bar, but it's a blast. Like, I love doing it. I love writing, man. I'm just very fortunate to do what I do.
Well, you've also been a showrunner, which is you're running the entire show. You are not just overseeing the writing room, but production, post-production, hiring the actors, everything.
Yeah, seven TV shows I've done that, yeah.
And, you know, when my wife does this, I basically don't see her for 6 months at a time.
Yeah, no, it's hugely, it's all-consuming.
All-consuming, exactly. Yeah. So do you like that, or is it more fun to kind of lay back a little bit and
I like
consulting?
It. I mean, I think the more I work in features, the more I love the feature life because I get to hang back and sort of consider things more carefully. And in television, sometimes you got to be like, okay, this is where we are. This is what we got to do. Let's get it done. And then as soon as you're done with that, you're on to something else. So it's super demanding. It's fun, but it's super demanding. Film to me is just it's hard, but it's a more solitary process to a great extent. Because, you know, obviously when you're a showrunner, you've got a staff. And I always like to say a showrunner has to be in three places. He's got to be in editing. He's got to be in the room, the writer's room. He's got to be on set. But a showrunner can only be in two places at one time.
So do you feed off that? Do you like all of the social energy that is involved?
I do, but then, you know, it is exhausting. So but you know, like, I know I speak for all the writers out there. It's hard out there for us. It's, you know.
Especially right at this moment.
Right now, you know, so I think any employment is deeply appreciated. And I'm grateful for whatever work I get.
You actually started in law, did you not?
I was an attorney, yeah.
And how and why did you make this transition into writing?
I was a lawyer for 3 years, 3 months, and 2 days. But, you know, who's counting? I just didn't, it wasn't for me. I mean, I think the education was great because it was sort of like I was an English major and like I had a lot of ideas about what was right and what was wrong in terms of art, and law school just threw a giant bucket of cold water in the form of logic upon my brain.
Yeah.
And it's just good to get that. But I didn't want to stay a lawyer. It was too dry. It was like being an accountant with words. I didn't want to do that.
And somehow you made this magic leap to writing screenplays.
Yeah, no, yeah, originally TV, yeah, yeah, yeah. Originally, The Adventures of Pete and Pete on Nickelodeon was my first job back in 95. Yeah, yeah.
Long way from Adventures to Pete and Pete, of Pete and Pete to The Holdovers.
Yeah, no, I've been very lucky, very lucky.
I imagine that hard work and talent had something to do with
thank
it
you,
as well.
Thank you.
You know, so far on the soundtrack, we've talked with music supervisor Gary Calamar. We've talked with composer Tyler Bates. You're our first showrunner, Dave, and I'd love to hear about your approach to working with music supervisors and composers. So let's take Kitchen Confidential, which, by the way, for our audience, was an incredible show starring this young guy named Bradley Cooper, John Francis Daly, John Cho, Frank Langella, Moreno Bacar, and a whole bunch more very, very talented folks.
We got nominated for the Writers Guild Award for Best Comedy 20 years ago. And we aired four times. Yeah, okay. It was crazy. It was a great show. It was my first love, really.
And
yeah.
Fox dropped it after one season. But let's not go into that.
Four episodes.
Yeah. Okay, so what was your idea for the musical treatment for Kitchen Confidential?
I wanted to, you know, it's based on Anthony Bourdain's book, Kitchen Confidential's memoir. So I wanted to have like a high degree of propulsiveness, but I also wanted to have that kind of like rock and roll energy. You know, I wanted to have that that rock and roll energy with a little sadness in it. And so Spoon figured very prominently, the band we heard earlier with the song Hot Thoughts. They were a huge,
and we started the show with The Way We Get,
Way
By.
We Get By, which, yeah. I wanted that to be the theme of the show, but the licensing,
what happened there?
The licensing situation was like draconian. There's no way we could have gotten it given what the network wanted.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, but I got to put a lot of their stuff on the soundtrack, and there's a huge amount of Clash music on the original broadcast version. Huge amount of Clash music, because back in the day, for whatever reason, this is before the Clash sort of became like the platinum master use. It's in the show, but then there's a DVD. I think you can get it somewhere. The DVD issue of the entire series.
I believe I have it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of that Clash music is on there. I think they had to back it out for the DVD. And
really? They couldn't afford it?
They couldn't afford to put it on the DVD.
Bummer.
Yeah. But I mean, for me, Andrew Van Forster, who is our music supervisor, who's just a wonderful person and a great, great music supervisor with fantastic taste, would turn me on to newer stuff. And I think when you're a showrunner, oftentimes the older cues, right? Like I said, Beatles, The Stones, Chambers Brothers, whatever, these are expensive cues.
Mm-hmm.
The newer bands, and you get new bands that are often played, for example, on here on the SoCal Sound, great new bands, you can pick them up relatively cheaply and break them on TV, and you can find a new way to sort of, you know, amplify the comedy and the drama on your show with a new voice, which is really great. And it's largely because the older stuff and the recognizable stuff is super expensive.
We're working our way towards another Spoon song. That was the longest. Oh, there it is. Yeah. We put a version on with like 3 minutes of the guys in the studio. So how do you then approach your music supervisor? In this case, the wonderful Andrea Van Forster. How did you work with her? Did you go in and say, I want these bands, or did she bring you CDs worth of music?
I kind of approached it from the standpoint of like, here's the tone that I want for the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know? This sort of, the tone for Kitchen Confidential for me was like, I wanted that indie, edgy, Anthony Bourdain feeling. And I mean, I think for Anthony, it would have been like, you know, the MC5 and Iggy Pop and the Stooges. And,
sure.
You know, I mean, that sort of like punk thrash. And as you can hear some of this with Spoon, it has a more melodic version of that. I mean, it's an indie band. But it has this sort of melodic rock quality to it. And I asked her about that, and she would go out and find me bands that sort of kind of coincided with that vibe, you know. And it was just sort of like, how can we do this so it's fun, it's a little wry, it's smart, but it rocks, and it's a little gritty, you know.
Did you have enough in the budget for one or two needle drops each episode?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, you did? Okay, that's cool.
Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah, I think we had a total of like 5 or 6 Spoon songs over the course of that first season.
You also had Daniel Light was the composer.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great guy. He went on to do my wife's show, Dexter,
after that. Yeah.
How often did you get to sit down with him? Would you go to spotting sessions?
I would occasionally go to spotting sessions, yeah. I mean, when I'm running a show, I like to be, again, like I said, a showrunner has to be in 3 places at the same time. Mm-hmm. Or be in 2, really. You know, it's just you have to clone yourself in a weird way. So whenever you can drop in to spotting, you go. And I love being on a soundstage. I love like working with a composer to try to get it just right, you know. Typically what you'll do is you'll hear cues up against a rough cut, and you'll decide, like, you know, before the picture's locked, you'll decide like, do these two things go together? But music is so crucially important. It's important to get
in. You sound like you were very hands-on with that process.
Yeah, totally.
very interesting. All right, Dave, this has been amazing chatting with you about this stuff. I wish we had another hour to talk about it. Let me just say to our audience very briefly that next time on The Soundtrack, we are going to have on multiple Emmy Award-winning composer Sean Callery, who's written the music for shows like 24, Bones, Designated Survivor, Jessica Jones, Elementary, and Homeland, to name a few. Sean's a fascinating guy as well. You don't want to miss that one. David, what can I say? It's been an unmitigated pleasure having you here tonight.
We don't have Death or Glory.
All right. Let's play some more Spoon. We love Spoon.
Yeah. We do love Spoon.
We're playing it fast and loose here. Are you allowed to tell us anything about what's coming down the pike for you? Are you still wading through offers? Is there like a mountain of offers?
I'm just trying to do good work, man. I got some stuff in the pipeline, which is nice. And Alexander Payne and I are writing a Western together, which is pretty exciting. We're co-writing a picture. We're co-writing a Western together. Yeah, so we're working on that. So I can talk about that. But everything else is sort of like in the hopper.
Do you think that at any point in the Western, people may stop and break into song?
I think we're going to use that cue we heard from Dino and Ricky
Just
Nelson.
Just use the same song.
Yeah. Why not?
I'm writing this to you in reverse. Someone better call a I can see it all from here, from just a few glimpses. Now that light bulb's gone off and it's pulling my wincing. Now the light bulb's gone off. I've seen it in your eyes. There's nothing there. There's nothing there. I wanna show you how I love you.